Earth Sky.
Welcome to Earth Sky 22, a weekly mix of global science interviews and local music from Austin, Texas. I'm Jorge Salazar. This week, sunspots and solar dimming, the science of illusions, saving wild tigers, and getting smart with bacteria. Here's a scientist soundbite.
The next sunspot cycle after the current one could be delayed by 2 to 5 years at least, and perhaps longer. We have, or at the other extreme, it could mean that there are maybe no sunspots appearing at all for an extended period of time.
You're listening to astronomer Frank Hill of the U.S. National Solar Observatory. Dr. Hill led research that found something new happening with the sun, indications that sunspot activity might drop dramatically starting around the year 2019. Dr. Hill is on the line now to talk more about the study. Welcome to the program, Dr. Hill.
Thank you very much.
What are the main findings of your study, which you co-authored, that is about jet streams below the surface of the sun and what that has to do with the solar cycle?
Well, we have been for 16 years now observing the inside of the sun using a technique called helioseismology. The sun is filled with sound waves, acoustic waves, that penetrate and travel all the way throughout the sun and are visible when they strike the surface of the sun from the inside, making the surface move up and down. By using this data, we can infer how the motions of the gas inside the sun are moving, and we have found that there is a jet stream, which had been observed previously on the surface in 1981, that is very tightly timed to the solar cycle. When the jet stream moves, this jet stream typically first appears at a high latitude on the sun near the solar poles, approximately 10 to 12 years before the start of the solar cycle, and it then moves first towards the poles, and then down another branch appears, and it moves down towards the equator. We should be seeing the poleward branch of this flow, which is also known as the torsional oscillation, for cycle 25, which is the next cycle of sunspots after the one we are in, which is cycle 24. We should have seen that flow back in 2008, and we still have not seen it. And so this leads us to believe that there is something different about cycle 25 than we have previously seen.
So would you mind maybe just to make these connections for us? There are these jet streams on the surface of the sun, and those are connected to the activity of sunspots, and then that is also connected to how hot the sun gets.
Yes, it is. Sunspots, when the sun has sunspots on it, the sun is a little bit brighter than when it does not. So if there's a lack of sunspots, then the sun is a little bit dimmer. And by a little bit, I mean a tenth of a percent. It's a very small percentage, a very small fraction.
Maybe just to dig into that question just a little bit more, what does this all mean?
Well, it could mean a range of things. It could mean that the next sunspot cycle after the current one could be delayed by 2 to 5 years at least, and perhaps longer. We have, or at the other extreme, it could mean that there are maybe no sunspots appearing at all for an extended period of time, that we may be entering what was a situation similar to the Maunder minimum, which was a period of 70 years or so from 1645 to 1715, where no visible sunspots or very few visible sunspots were observed. Those are just two extremes of the possibilities.
That minimum was associated with the Little Ice Age, I believe. Is that right?
It was, anecdotally. However, there are some indications that the connection with the Little Ice Age may not be quite as strong as some people claim. It partly depends on how you define the Little Ice Age. But in some measures, you can say the Little Ice Age can be thought to have occurred 100 to 300 years before the Maunder minimum itself. So while part of it coincided with the Maunder minimum, not all of it did. So it's not clear that there really was a cause and effect. It's definitely a very gray area, and of course we don't have very good data on it because it happened so long ago.
Now, would you tell us a little bit about the data that your team collected? What is the evidence to support these claims of a possible major drop in solar activity for the next solar cycle, starting, I believe, around 2013 or so?
Well, no, that's not quite correct. 2013, we'll actually see a maximum. We are talking that a maximum of the current solar cycle, which is number 24. What we're talking about is the next solar cycle, number 25, which should start, if things go right, in about 2019, 2020. What we are claiming is that it may not start in 2019, 2020, may be delayed for till 2025, or something of that nature, or even longer. We don't know. We cannot tell yet.
Yeah, thank you for clarifying that.
Sure. But the evidence is this. This torsional oscillation, this jet stream flow, which we are observing inside the sun as well with helioseismology, is very tightly correlated with the timing of the solar cycle. For instance, you may have heard of the long, deep minimum that we just emerged from between cycles 23 and 24. That minimum was approximately one and a half years longer than what we usually experience. We found that the torsional oscillation, the jet stream, which migrates from high to low latitudes, was migrating at a much slower rate than it had in the past, and that it took about 1.5 years longer to reach the latitude at which sunspots begin to appear. And that made us realize that that observing this phenomenon could provide sort of a clock and sort of a future predictor for what would be happening for the overall solar cycle itself.
Are you familiar with any media reports that have gotten this story wrong?
Yes, actually. It seems to me that a lot of the reports that came out said we have predicted a new ice age. And that is making the leap then from low sunspot activity to cooling. We did not predict a little ice age. What we predicted was something that the sun will be doing, not what the Earth's climate will be doing. So that, I believe, has been the major inaccuracy that I have seen in the media at this point.
Now, how firm are these predictions of low solar activity starting around 2019, 2020?
Well, they are definitely based on our interpretation of the data that we have now. It is certainly possible that the sun will surprise us again, as it frequently does, and will quickly pick up activity in spite of what we are seeing now. There are two other indicators that the solar cycle may be going into a different state that were also discussed in the course of our press conference. One is that coronal emissions, which the corona is the tenuous outer atmosphere of the sun, light of a certain wavelength in the corona also tracks the magnetic flux, the sunspots, and traces them out. And it too shows a lack of the phenomena that we expect in advance of cycle 25. The other piece of evidence is that the sunspots themselves apparently are getting weaker in terms of their magnetic field strength, and they are getting brighter, so they are fading from view, and they have been since the middle of cycle 23 and now into this cycle 24 as well. If you extrapolate that effect, then sunspots will vanish also in the time frame of 2020 to 2025. So we have these three independent lines of observations, of evidence, all of which can be interpreted to mean that the solar cycle will either be greatly delayed or may be going into hibernation.
You've been listening to astronomer Frank Hill, Associate Director of the U.S. National Solar Observatory. We're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. Sky. Wild tigers are in trouble. That is, they're nearly extinct. That's according to Dr. John Seidensticker. Beth Lebwohl is here with the story.
Hey, thanks, Jorge. So John Seidensticker is a senior scientist at the Smithsonian's National Zoological Park in Washington, D.C. And I spoke to him in late 2010, just after he came back from a meeting in St. Petersburg, Russia. It was organized as an international effort to prevent wild tigers' extinction, because they're on their way. Dr. Seidensticker explained that only about 3,200 tigers remain in the wild. All of them live in Asia.
3,200 would be a nice number of tigers if you had them in one place or two or three places. But in fact, they're divided up into probably more than 76 small populations that are not connected anymore.
Experts predict that without international intervention, wild tigers will go extinct by the year 2022. Seidensticker explained why.
Tigers have been recognized as endangered for 40 years. But in that 40-year period, they're twice the number of people that live in the Asian countries where tigers live.
To support Asia's double-digit population growth, and also economic growth, tiger habitat has been eaten up. In addition, Seidensticker said, poaching is another major threat to tigers.
There's an increased demand for tiger hides, for decor. There's an increased demand for meat. So we have a massive illegal wildlife trade that's not under control.
Beth, about the meeting in St. Petersburg, how did it even come to pass?
Good question, Jorge. It was called by the president of Russia and also the head of the World Bank. And also attending were representatives of a bunch of Asian nations. Seidensticker said it was actually unprecedented to get so many countries at the same table. Nepal, China, Russia, Bangladesh, and Laos were the five major players. And some of these countries actually don't have good political relations.
So what really happened at the tiger meeting?
Well, in short, they declared a willingness to double the number of tigers in the world within the next 12 years. And these countries are all working together to get the legal and the financial backing. Dr. Seidensticker himself was sort of musing, if we can't manage to save tigers, can we manage to save any animal at all? Because tigers figure so prominently in the collective imagination.
Thanks, Beth.
Hey, thank you, Jorge.
Earth Sky's Beth Lebois. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
No, you won't leave me hanging. We spring from and return to the earth, but in between, you will always belong to me. And if you want, we can go out tonight and be alone. And if you want, we can go out tonight and be alone. And if you let's do what we please, let's love what we do, it's you and me, a nation of two, let's do what we please, let's love what we do.
Thank you.
combination of two. We do what we please. We love what we do. It's you and me. A nation of two. We do what we please. We love what we do. It's you and me.
We're Earth Sky, heard on 1500 radio stations around the world. Ryan Britton is here to tell us a weird science story about how a common type bacteria might make you smarter and even happier. Ryan, what's up?
Yeah, it's bacteria that's actually found in dirt that might have this effect on you. We really don't know yet, but microbiologists at the Sage Colleges of New York found that feeding mice bacteria that's often found in soil, can actually make the mice smarter. So they put mice through a maze, and the mice that were fed bacteria completed the maze twice as fast as the control group, which received, they were fed no bacteria. So researchers were actually surprised by the marked improvement. It was, as they described, a complicated maze.
So, Ryan, were the mice happy to be solving this maze?
Yeah, well, they displayed less anxiety in the maze. So I'm assuming that mazes are stressful to mice. And so apparently they were cooler about figuring the way out. The interesting thing is that the reason behind all of this is that the bacteria that the mice ate, they found stimulates the growth of certain neurons in the brain that produce serotonin. And serotonin is known as the happiness hormone and is also associated with the ability to learn. So researchers think that this is the source of the increased intelligence and lack of anxiety.
So you're not saying that we should all go out and eat dirt, are you?
No, I wouldn't do that quite yet. As I mentioned earlier, there's no evidence that this works on humans. Also, we're pretty well exposed to this type of bacteria on a daily basis just by walking around outside. But the one thing that researchers point out is that there could be eventually a case made for recess, and that's spending time outside on a playground during a school day. Here in the U.S., recess time for kids has been shrinking in favor of more classroom time. But here you have children with developing brains being exposed to bacteria outside, and so this could be a good thing for their intelligence, their ability to learn, and their well-being. So. I've always enjoyed recess, so it's a good enough argument for me.
Yeah, we should all have more recess.
Right, and we can justify that with this story. You can find it on abcnews.com, sciencedaily.com, discovery.com, among others.
Thanks, Ryan.
You're welcome.
Earth Sky is Ryan Britton. We're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. Earth Sky, and we're heard 15 million times daily around the world on 1500 radio stations, including Voice of America. We turn now to the science of illusions. On the line today, we have neuroscientist Mark Changizi, who's recently written a book called The Vision Revolution, how the latest research overturns everything we thought we knew about human vision. Dr. Changizi, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
Why do we see illusions?
As a starting point, most people have seen these classical geometrical illusions, but just to get one of them in mind, let me describe the herring illusion. This is one of these that you have a bunch of spokes coming out of a point, just radially sort of coming out of a point, and then you have a vertical line going down the left side of the center and a vertical line going down the right side of the center. And what you actually perceive in this case is that the vertical lines don't look straight. They look like they're bowing outwards. When light hits your eye, you'd like to instantaneously create a perception of what the world is like. But the problem is that your brain can't instantaneously create a perception because your brain has to compute stuff, and it's got to just send the signal through actual distance to the back of your head. In fact, it takes about a tenth of a second to generate a perception of what was out there. And if you didn't do any corrections for that delay, then if I was moving at just 1 meter per second, then if I perceived something to be 10 centimeters from passing me, then by the time that perception actually happened, I would have already bumped into or have just passed the thing. So what your brain wants to do and would have been selected during evolutionary eras to do is to not try to generate a perception of what was out there when light hit the retina, but to guess how that world will be in a tenth of a second after that, because you want to anticipate the near future, because by the time you've generated a perception of that near future, the future will have arrived. That's half of the story. The other half of the story is, okay, when you have a bunch of spoke lines in this illusion that I described, when you move around in the world, your eyes actually take little snapshots. They don't sort of scan smoothly. They land on the spot, they take a little snapshot, and they saccade someplace else, and they take another snapshot. And if you're moving forward, then when you take that snapshot, you'll get optic flow that flows outwards from roughly the direction that you're going, kind of like when in Star Trek they go into warp and they get all this radial flow going outwards. And so when you have an image like this herring illusion that I described, where all these lines are emanating from a point, and you see it's not actually, there's no motion there, but your brain is happy to not see motion and yet infer it, because that's what it does all the time when it takes these little snapshots in the world. And so what it wants to do now that it knows what direction it's moving, it doesn't want to generate a perception of those two vertical lines as just being vertical lines. It wants to say how they will distort in a tenth of a second were I moving in that direction. So in the herring illusion, you actually see the bowing outwards, even in the static thing, because your brain is desperately trying to anticipate the way the world is going to change in the next moment so that you have a perception of reality. In this case, of course, it's just a drawing on a piece of paper, so your brain has been tricked.
Neuroscientist Mark Changizi on the science of illusions. And that's our show. Thanks for joining us. This week's show was recorded at the Earth Sky Studios in Austin, Texas, live music capital of the world. Our producer is Michael Brennan. Executive producers are Peter Zandan, Ryan Britton, and Deborah Bird. Our audio engineer is Eddie Campos. And special thanks this week to our musical contributors, Okote Soul Sounds, Quiet Company, 100 Flowers, and the Black and White Years. For more information on the science and the music you heard this week, visit our website at earthsky.org. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
There are too many artists, too much art, and not enough genius, I believe. Science is the art of the next age. There are so many artists, too much art, and not enough reason, I'm afraid. Silence is the song of the next age.